Hello, good morning. You're very welcome to the programme. Between now and nine, we are in fallen forests in Meath and shredded polytunnels in Galway. We'll ask Forestry and Horticulture Minister Michael Healy-Ray how he'll help picking up the pieces. And for the day that's in it, a gathering of the Brigids in Kerry. I was in the car a lot this week through Sligo, East Galway, Leitrim, Roscommon, right the way through West Meath and Meath. And I have to say, it was almost as if somebody had swept their hand across a chessboard and sent the pieces scattering everywhere. There wasn't a farm or a field or a village green that wasn't showing the signs of the aftermath of Éowyn. Trees down, fences uprooted, shed roofs in a crumpled mess everywhere. And it has left a lot of people in a real bind, especially people with forestry. I visited John Sherlock just outside Navan. Now, he knew that his 16 acres of Sitka plantation were in trouble, but it was too dangerous to go in and assess how much trouble on foot. So when I went up to him, he got a neighbour to fly a drone over the wood to see what was left standing.
I looked at the edges, so I did, and I got up on banks and I looked, and there were trees laying everywhere.
How much of it do you think you've lost?
Oh, I'd say 90% of it.
And the reason you're sending up a drone now, John, is that these are dangerous places to be.
This is about the most dangerous place you could go into now as a forest with this, because you have trees hanging on other trees. And if you actually thought, oh, there's no wind, and you walk in, and who's to know, you might just disturb something, and then a tree falls and another one captures you. Look at that, there, look at that. The whole field gone.
How much do you reckon you've lost?
It could be up on 100,000. We don't know. We're in uncharted territory. It's a 22-year-old crop so far. That was a very high-yielding crop. Really, really, really spent time and money on this. We don't know what we're going to get when we take it out. We don't know what market there'll be. We don't know when we're going to get to take it out. Trees lying in on each other, trees lying on the ground, you know, broken trees, snapped trees, one in here, one actually, a load of them falling out over the hedge in on top of me, trees that I replanted from the ash day back.
There's also no rhyme or reason to the way they've fallen. They're at all kinds of different angles, facing different directions. It's going to be a nightmare to untangle all that.
Well, normally if wind throw comes, it normally knocks it generally in a direction. But you can see that one's that way, this one's that way. Look at the trees that were snapped over there.
It's like a game of Jenga. You don't know which one, when you remove it, is going to cause all of the others to fall.
And the other thing is, look at all the ground that's disturbed here now with the roots. Like, the carbon loss here to Ireland as a nation is going to be absolutely unbelievable here. Because you've all these trees been removed. You've all these roots been uprooted. All this carbon escaping. It's a disaster. It's a pure disaster now.
It was your father that started the planting on your land, wasn't it?
Yeah.
What do you think it would have done to him?
Otterbroken.
To see this in this condition?
It'd break his heart now. Very tough for him now. Because we sort of put our heart into it, you know. And we sort of built a family enterprise around it too, you know.
So what was your forester saying to you?
The forester was saying that at the moment I have only a tenant licence. I haven't a clear fell licence. So now, for me to take out my crop, I have to apply to the Department of Agriculture for a clear felling licence.
It takes 6 to 9 months on average at the moment to get a felling licence.
You'd be doing well to get it in 9 months. Mine took me about nearly almost a year.
How long can you leave wood like that lying on the ground before the only use for it ever will become pulp?
That is the question. I asked two foresters that question And they said it depends on whether it's snapped, whether it's lying over.
Snapped, it'll never be any use to the construction industry. If it's taken the roots up, it can be.
It can be. As long as it stays green, this is my. But I spoke to a man that does harvesting, and he said, at using his own present equipment and with his present customers, he wouldn't take out all the clearfell in a year.
Okay, so you're going to miss the replanting window.
Oh, yeah.
This winter 2025 completely. There's no chance of that, is there?
No.
So and possibly winter 2026.
We are looking at the realistic thing is winter 2026.
What is going to happen to the price of timber once everybody does start taking this stuff out? Presumably it's going to go through the floor.
This is a conversation we're going to have. Are the sawmills going to treat us with a bit of respect? Are they going to not try and take advantage of our stones?
John, there'd be a lot of people who would be in their 70s, in their 80s, yeah, who would have invested in forestry. How badly hit are they going to be by this? Because that's the retirement plan, presumably.
At the minute, they're left hanging. They are left hanging. I'd be very concerned for them on a mental health level because, you see, we don't know. They don't know what they're facing into. We're not looking for charity. We're looking for help. And if that means expediting the removal of the affected timber from the forest.
Okay, so basically an amnesty on the felling licences. That's what you think you need.
Well, put resources in that they'll guarantee forest owners just to get in, that they'll get their forest application approved. All that has to be put in place while the timber is lying on the ground. And now we have
rotting. Slowly.
Rotting. And then we have, if you look at it from Caolte, Caolte have a huge area of forestry. They're in the same issue as us. So all this timber is going to just appear.
Government's appointed a task force. What does it need to do? How quickly does it need to make its decisions?
A task force is a good idea, but it needs to really, really, really move fast. I think what we need to do is we need to try and reassure people. Let's start where we need to reassure people that we as a state and an industry are not going to abandon them in their day of need. That's what we need first. When we need that made clear, we don't need missives sent to us from bodies telling us what we can and we can't do. We want assurance that we will be helped and that we won't be left standing.
John Sherlock in Navan there. Michael Healy-Ray is the Junior Minister in the Department of Agriculture with special responsibility for both forestry and horticulture, two of the hardest hit areas in the last week. He joins me on the line from his home in Kilgarvan. Good morning, Minister.
Good morning, Philip, and good morning, John, and to all your listeners. And I'm grateful for the opportunity of being on this show.
Well, we're grateful that you got up and you were able to talk to us this morning. You set up the task force, as John was saying there. It's going to meet first now on Tuesday morning. What people like John want to know is, how long are you going to give this task force to do its work and to report back to you? And what are you going to be doing in the meantime?
Well, first of all, I have approved the setting up of the Windblow Task Force to coordinate the response to the storms, with particular emphasis on dealing with being safe about this problem. And because of the large areas of forest that have blown down, the Department of Agriculture, Food and Forestry and Fisheries and the Marine has published a windblow and storm damage guidelines for forest owners in the week before the storm one actually occurred. But one thing that I'm very conscious of when I was listening to John there, he doesn't want to hear gobbledygook coming from the department. And I can guarantee him that's not going to be the case. This is going to be a serious plan of working with and working for the farmers that have been affected. I listened very closely to when he said he'd hope that the sawmills will not try and take advantage of this situation. I'm very, very hopeful that that will not be the case. And I'll tell you why. The sawmills that we have in Ireland, many of them are family businesses. They appreciate the fact that farmers plant trees. So they will not be in this for what I would call a quick book. And I won't allow that happen. And I know they won't want it to happen. Because when it comes to growing trees, you're part of a team. You need the farmer to grow the trees. You need the hauler to haul them. You need the people to harvest them to haul them. And then the sawmills to be there and to be working with you. Of course, like anything, it's like going to the market with a cow. They'd hoping to be doing the best they could, of course, for themselves. But they do realise you have to be fair about an emergency situation okay. like this. There are immediate things. Sorry?
Well, let me just move you on, because we don't have a huge amount of time, Minister. I'm sure that people will be reassured what you're saying about the sawmills, particularly as I think 75% of what goes through Irish sawmills goes to the continent, where the price is going to remain constant because there wouldn't be enough Irish timber to affect the price there. So it should, as you say, stay at a fair price. But the thing that I think most people want to hear you talking about this morning is the felling licences, which at the moment are taking between 9 and 12 months to grant. Now, in Wales, as you heard John Sherlock say, they took a very simple step after Storm Dara. They just published the following announcement. They said, "We will not take enforcement action against you for failure to obtain a felling licence for woodland management activities needed as a direct result of Storm Dara." Could you do the same for Storm Éowyn?
Well, immediately after the storm, I studied very much what they did in Wales and how they handled the situation. 15 minutes after being appointed by the Taoiseach, I sat down with officials in my department and I raised this very point with them about the felling licences. Now, there is one thing for people to know and to understand. And obviously, this is not the case in all of the fallen timber. But you must understand that many of the thousands of hectares that are on the ground now actually possess a licence already, because licences had been issued and licences had been granted.
So they can move ahead, but for those that don't, what are you going to be able to do?
And just one other point on that. Remember where people had thinning licences. Right. I can see no reason in the world why a thinning license shouldn't be changed to a felling license, because all the necessary and appropriate assessments have taken place. So those are practical things that I'm going to be looking at with my officials.
And will that happen? Will that happen now, Minister, or is that just your hope?
No. There's another point I want to make. When you talk about speed dialing licenses, there's a very important issue that we have to be careful about in Ireland, and this is very important for you to hear and for your listeners to hear. When a license is granted, it has to be extremely robust and not open to challenge in any shape or fashion. That is important, because we do have a lot of instances in Ireland where that is a problem for us. So I don't want to see a farmer getting a license quickly that will actually be no good to him, because in 2 years' time he might be still held up because of challenges. And believe me, people watch out for things like that. And if they don't see a thing being done right, they will challenge it. So I don't want that to happen to farmers. That would actually be the worst thing that could possibly happen. And so we'll take whatever steps we can to issue the licences quickly. I was very grateful.
Give us a timeline on what quickly is in your mind, though, Minister, because at the moment there are foresters who are looking at trees that are going to start rotting.
Yes. Well, as you know, at the moment it's taking 6 to 9 months. That is a vast improvement on what the situation was before. And I know that the senior minister and the secretary general and all the different heads of the departments, when we met the other day, a big group of us, this is a major concern to us, that we do act in the quickest but surest way mm-hmm. that we can.
Well, I hear you on that, but have you a timeline in mind then, do you?
I do, and I'll tell you exactly what the timeline is. The quickest way we can do it, that will be pro-farmer, that will be pro the people on the ground that have grown the trees, and at the same time, that it will be robust and not open to challenge. Because if I was to say tomorrow morning, Philip, literally at the drop of a hat, these licences should be issued. And if every licence then that we issued was challenged, And if we finished up in 12 months or in a year and a half or in 2 years' time...
I hear what you're saying, but you know, in Wales...
That would be the worst thing you could do.
Absolutely agreed. But in Wales, they were able to do it within 3 weeks. Do you not think that a similar timeline is achievable here?
I would absolutely agree with you that that would be great. But you must know what happens on the ground here when it comes to dealing with licences.
Okay.
And you must understand that we have, unfortunately, a history here in Ireland of people on the sidelines watching what a department does. And if they see any weakness in the actions of that department, they challenge it. And I don't want us to fall victim of that.
All right, Minister, and I need you to stay with us now.
I think that's very, very important.
I want you to stay with us while we move on to the other part of your brief to horticulture. There's another interview I'd like you to take a listen to, please. Because in my travels this week, I noticed that second only to trees, Storm Éowyn focused much of its wrath on polytunnels. Where growers had two, one would be gone. Where they had four, two would be gone. And the polythene would be wrapped around the top of a tree several hundred yards away. Passing through East Galway, between Gledamaddy and Williamstown, I called into Mick Wright and Audrey Heshen and their organic salad leaf business in Millhouse Farm, a business which until last Friday operated almost entirely under polytunnels.
You slept through it, you had your earphones in. I was awake most of the night.
Come, I put the earphones in because I don't want to hear what's happening.
Okay. I was worried the roof was going to come off the house at one stage. I imagined that it was going to be fairly bad out here, but I didn't really picture what was waiting me.
Lord.
We had 26 tunnels in production Thursday. And by Friday morning, we're down to 13.
Exactly half. Mm. Yeah.
And some of them, like the structures, are gone.
The whole metal frames have just been twisted and absolutely scrunched up, haven't they?
Yeah.
Oh, lads.
If you want to guess how many tunnels this was from that tangled mess, I'll let you keep them.
It's hard to tell where where one starts and the other finishes.
Yeah, it's like a bowl of spaghetti, isn't it?
It is. Yeah.
Dare I ask the question about whether you're insured and whether you can claim on this?
I'll have to get in contact with the insurance company and see where that is. We're insured, but, you know, we haven't. These were all done. You built them all yourself over the years. Second-hand tunnels, repurposed old mushroom tunnels. So they're not itemised, on the insurance. But we'll see.
Are you worried that if you were to make a claim on this now that you might not get insurance again in the future?
Possibly. I'll have to look at it. I don't know. I'll just have to inquire when we get our phone back.
When you get your phone back.
Yeah.
That'd be the appalling vista, wouldn't it, Mick? That an actuarial accountant somewhere would end up saying, no, do you know what? It's not worth our while. It's too risky a business insuring growers in this country. And that would be what would end up deciding whether you're in business or not.
It's not something I really think about too much. You know, we're in this for what we do at farm. We'll find a way through it and that's it. It's a mess to look at it now, but close your eyes and imagine what it'll be in a year's time again.
You see yourself in business in a year's time. This is not going to put you out of business.
No. We do need supports to get through this. You know, we do. Maybe with the TAMS scheme and the horticultural scheme, they need to look at opening that now, like to maybe fast track some grant schemes now. And so,
but what are you looking for from government? How quickly do they need to move?
As quick as possible, really. You know, next month will be, you know, just to get an order in with a company to get the frames built.
And you wouldn't have the peace of mind placing that order unless you knew that there was going to be some level of government support there.
You would need to know beforehand. Yeah. Like, you can't approach a project like this. Like, you're talking about 1,500 square metres of tunnels just in this block. That's a six-figure investment.
That would be an improvement for us. Like, if we did it in one block, it would be ultimately better than what we had beforehand, you know, so...
Yeah.
Have you done a back of an envelope calculation as to what you're looking at here?
Yes, this is the man here. Yeah. He never stops.
it's north of 100,000 euros.
Gulp.
Yeah.
Is this heartbreaking or is this soul destroying? Where is it on that spectrum?
Well, you can't really think about that. You just have to think about getting it back into production, really, yeah. You know. It's, what else can you do?
Build back better. Move forward.
You know, there's no point in looking back. It is what it is. Just move on.
Yeah.
Unfortunately, that's the case.
And okay, well, you're made of tougher stuff than I am then, because I'm looking at this and it would almost bring you to tears thinking about how much work you have ahead of you here.
Yeah.
Speaking of building back better, if you were able to rebuild all of this as glass rather than as polythene tunnel, would you be more climate-proofed?
Possibly, yeah. Storms like that, it's hard to know really what's going to happen. Like, the wind speeds were phenomenal. You know, I've from Wexford, I've lived by the coast, and I've lived in West Clare by the coast, and I've seen storms, but nothing like what we had. Like, winds like that are just crazy. It's hard to know what it would stand it.
Just that I noticed when I was in the Netherlands about a year or so ago that they have quite a big industry in selling second-hand greenhouses.
Yeah. It probably is something that should be looked at in Ireland, like in grant schemes should be opened up maybe more for second-hand as well. We can certainly source a lot better over there than we can here.
Maybe the storm Eowyn's, nothing is going to withstand that, but for the storm Dara's, would a greenhouse, glass greenhouse, be a little bit more robust?
Greenhouses are, glass is more robust, and as well, because it's in panes, you might lose some glass, but you can replace sections. Once polythene goes, it's gone, like it's a complete tunnel, has to be redone.
Mick and Audrey there in Williamstown and Galway. Junior Minister in the Department of Agriculture, Michael Healy-Ray, is still with us. Minister, a grower said to me during the week, if I failed a TB test, I would have vets and I would have department officials at the gate within hours offering advice and a compensation check. But if you lose a polytunnel in a storm, the department doesn't seem to have a clue what it is that they should be doing. Growers say, and they're texting the programme this morning already, they're saying they want to hear clear, unqualified, unambiguous message of support from you this morning. Have you got their backs?
Oh, I absolutely would, because outside of Audrey and Mick, I have been contacted by people from the horticulture sector very strongly, obviously, over the last number of days. Now, the work is ongoing, as some of the growers are actually still assessing the situation on the ground, and indeed the full extent of the damage caused may not become apparent until the repairs commence and until crops develop. But I will be meeting with representatives of all the horticultural subsectors at a meeting of the Horticulture Industry Forum on the 11th of February. Now, that was to be the 25th, but I looked for it to be brought forward because of the urgency of the situation. This will provide me with an opportunity to hear directly from the growers on the impacts of the storm on their sector, as well as the wider issues and opportunities for the sector. Mm-hmm. Now, there is a provision in the programme for government to develop an extreme weather event system scheme for homes, communities and organisations, and farmers and businesses. Now, I am engaging with my government colleagues on this issue, and I will be doing that very strongly after I meet with the representatives of the horticultural industry on the 11th, because I know that Minister Martin Hayden and all of my other colleagues are extremely concerned for this very important sector. And I know what they want to hear today is they want to hear, what is the government going to do to help us? I
can very specifically on that, Minister, what they really want to hear is that when somebody like Mick Wright makes a phone call to a polytunnel supplier, he wants to know that the government is going to underwrite him. Are you of a mind to do that?
Well, whether you're of a mind to do it or not, of course I would be of a mind to do it. But again, I can only do what I can do. And the one thing that I can tell these people that are affected, I really appreciate on the ground what has happened to them. It is soul destroying to go out and see a lifetime of work maybe damaged or half damaged or completely destroyed. I know what that's like. As a person who's gone through all life's difficulties myself, yeah. I know what situations like that
are. The kind
like
words
are
always appreciated, so, but they want to hear something concrete this morning, Minister.
Well, the biggest concrete thing that I can tell them is that, yes, I will be ensuring that everything that is within my remit to do, And I know that my colleagues will want to do the same. There is provisions in the programme for government for urgent situations like this. It is a matter of, first of all, assessing what is required, quantifying what is required, and then lobbying and fighting to get that to help them. But I have no intention in the world of letting a very important sector like this in our agri-food business, of abandoning them or letting them on to their own devices. We will be doing everything we can to assist them.
Because the magnitude of this is really quite serious. And when you think about what could be, we could be looking at a couple of months from now, because if growers have lost their propagation tunnels and they don't get them reinstated within the next 8 to 12 weeks, there's going to be no seedlings for them to plant, which in turn means that there's going to be food shortages this summer, which could lead to some really serious food price inflation this summer. That's what's at stake here, Minister.
But yes, Philip, but you're 100% correct. And if you remember at the very beginning, that's what I said to you. The work is ongoing because you have to, first of all, assess the problem and evaluate it and see what the total context of it is to know how you're going to react it. And right now, this minute, nobody can actually come up forward and say, well, this is a total assessment of the damage done. And that is why I wanted to bring forward the meeting from the 25th of February to the 11th, because it is really, really important that we bring all the stakeholders together and that we then know the full extent, because I am hearing the horror stories from here and from there. But we need, it's very easy, for example, to go out with the satellites and do what we did in the forestry sector.
But we don't need the satellites. I mean, you have Mick Wright there saying, look, the total damage is €100,000. He wants to know today, as do other growers, have you got his back in putting his business back the way that it was before A1 arrived?
I answered to that already, but I was just making the point. It's easier to assess some situations than others. And that's why this, you said it yourself, the total impact of this is not going to be realised for a while because of the knock-on effects. It's not just what you see happening today or the damage done. It's the future aspects of the detrimental effect that's going to have in your business and your crops. So will I have their backs? Is this going to be a time that government are going to abandon or support? I can assure you, from the Taoiseach, to Minister Hayden, to myself and everyone else, we do have the backs, because I said this at the very beginning of this government. This is going to be a government of listening, of understanding and of wanting to help people in all the different sectors.
Minister,
and of course now at this urgent time in forestry and horticulture and all farming sectors, because a lot of other sectors of farming have been affected as well with the situation.
Indeed, sheds, but horticulture and forestry and are your responsibilities. That's why we were 100%. Talking to you about this morning. Minister Michael Healy-Ray, thank you very much. Now, none of the people that you have heard on the programme this morning so far have electricity. Still, countrywide regulars will know Keith Brennan and his family farm in County Roscommon. Now, Storm Dara tore through their small holding before Christmas and the family lived without power for more than 8 days. Then Storm Éowyn struck just as they were picking up the pieces from the last storm. And as Keith explains in his letter to Countrywide from Hawthorne Hill Farm.
It's the night before Éowyn and I'm in Ballinamore. A meeting to discuss the fallout from Storm Dara. Stories are pouring into the room. People remembering the trees, blocked roads, days and for some the week of no water, no internet, no light, no heat. Some are 6 weeks later with no water still. The room is thronged. The storm and the anger at what has been has drawn many tonight. We talk, share and plan. Place our stories, hope and trust in one another, in community. There is a sense of being failed by organisations, companies and regulations that many feel protect profit over people. Storm Éowyn comes. I watch through the bedroom window on my farm as the trees windscreen wipe across the dawning sky. The rending crack of broken or uprooted trees. The whole entire woods behind my house scrubbed clean from the world. Pure sky where a forest last night had been. I go to clear the trees from the road. My son comes with me. We work, our breath braided steam in the frozen air, snow crunching underfoot, the rattle and drum of just-cut rounds of wood on the steel bed of the trailer, the tick-tick-tack of the hazard lights, the song of a thrush, and the roar of a distant saw at the same work as us. The next evening I'm amazed when my power returns, Neighbours, though, are not so lucky. We drop boxes of dried firewood to one. For another, we cook an oven roast dinner. She curls around our radiator like a settling cat. We heave gallons of water into the boot of her car before she drives back into the cold and dark of home. Days stretch into a week. The houses on the hill still dark, power lines coiled in gardens and on roads. They'll be dark and cold until the 5th. A week after Eowyn, I meet a neighbour. She stretches a hand through her car window. Feel my hands. She is in tears from the week-long cold. She drives off quickly, does not want me to see, the brokenness catching in her throat. The second storm has brought with it something new. Disbelief. How have we been left to fend so much for ourselves and one another? Where are the answers? Where is the help? Carnage and kindness happen together, and, though kindness springs from that disaster, it outlasts it. But I worry, too, that the anger will have a longer life than both.
Keith Brennan there. 0870 32 32 32 for your WhatsApp messages. And Gemma in Mayo says, listening to Audrey and Mick in Galway has given me goosebumps. The losses and the trauma from all of this. I hope Ireland can work quickly to help all of the farmers, because the public won't realise the effect of this until foodstuff is missing from the shelf. And as Keith Brennan said, carnage and kindness come together. That's something we'll be reflecting on after the break.
Email countrywide at rte.ie. Countrywide on RTE Radio 1.
It is St. Bridget's Day, of course. I hope you're enjoying the prospect of your bank holiday weekend. Here on Countrywide, we were wondering how 1,500 years ago in 525 AD, she would have responded to Storm Eowyn. At least, that was the intention when I visited St. Bridget's namesake, Farming for Nature Ambassador Bridget Murphy in Sligo. But the conversation went off in a very different direction.
Do you ever reflect on how puny we are in the face of the kind of forces that can lift a stone wall and an ancient tree like that
completely.
And just make matchsticks of them?
It's humbling. It's humbling, and it's actually, it takes the pressure off you, you know, when you look at the scale of what has to be done and how small and puny we are, as you mentioned, to tackle any of it. Sometimes it's quite nice knowing you're just a grain of sand. But when you put all of those grains of sand together, you get a beach, you get something. And that's also that sense that we were meant to come together. I mean, in the old days, farmers survived by helping each other out, by that concept of metal.
Dry stone wallers have always struck me as very philosophical people. Did this make you a philosopher?
You have no idea. It took me places and spaces. I was able to let go of some really deep resentment on this wall. Okay? I was able to forgive. I learned actually what the concept of forgiveness was. And when I get to the corner here, I'll show you, but I got to the corner. I couldn't see where I'd started. I couldn't see where I was going to finish. I picked up a rock. I dropped it. It smashed three of my fingernails, and I was sitting on the stones crying my eyes out. Now, picture this. It's November. I'm in a rain gear because it's lashing, but it's the time of the year I can get this done. And James Plunkett Leonard, who was an old neighbor, he drove up, and his window kind of creaked down on his car, and he said, "What's the matter?" And I said, "James, I can't carry on. This wall has broken me." So he said, "Look, I'll tell you what. I'll come up at 4 o'clock tomorrow afternoon," because it was November, so it was getting dark early. And he said, "I'll have a look and inspect the work that you've done." So the next morning I woke up and I rolled over and my back was broken and my hands were sore and I was just so despondent. And I went, I can't face that wall. And then I thought, Oma, James is coming up at 4. And if I've got nothing to show him, he'll have something to say to me. And he always had something to say to you. So I leapt out the bed and I did the next section. And every day for a month, he drove up.
On a practical level, since Storm Eowyn hit, what have you all been doing for each other?
All right. First of all, I arrived back and my wonderful neighbour had already had that tree cut. Yeah.
Now, that is very generous because nobody else has any need to go up your lane, do they?
Well, exactly. And funnily enough, the neighbour that I've spoken about with the stone walls, he actually cut a whole bunch that were posing a threat just before it.
Sometimes we're not great in this country about accepting people who we refer to as blow-ins. It must be kind of reassuring, though, that when an event like this happens, everybody pulls together and you're not a blow-in any longer. You're a neighbour.
You know, I think I'll always be a blow-in. I think I came here as a blow-in. My great-uncle Frank was born on this mountain. He went and worked in London. He retired back here and he was a blow-in for that. I mean, on one level, yes, I think I'll always be a blow-in. But in terms of the acceptance, you know, the old fella James that I was telling you about, he watched me for a while and then the one day he stopped and he said, "Your Uncle Tommy would be happy the way you're treating his sheep." And I suddenly realised I got one of the biggest compliments that was going.
And that was the moment of acceptance into this little community, do you think?
Well, certainly then he would have seen me as a neighbour farmer rather than just some very strange woman who pitched up and is living in a caravan on the side of a mountain. But no more than that, as I say, I mean, the neighbour here, Brian, he would help me out a lot. He's got tractors and quads and the ability to help me with a lot of that stuff. And by the same token, I've been able to help him out with extra grazing for his animals. And I do my own hay and silage. So if I had extra bales, he can pick them up. So we help each other out that way as well. But you are only as good as your neighbours, to tell the truth.
Bridget Murphy there reminding us that the number of emergency generators you have on standby is not the only measure of how resilient we are in the face of things like Storm Éowyn. Well, Brenda Donoghue heard that I was going to be talking to a modern day Bridget, the patron saint of livestock. So not to be outdone, she of course went off and gathered as many Bridgets into the one place as she could possibly find. The Kerry Traveller Health and Community Development Project provides practical services, advocacy support in areas like health and education and accommodation, while, as you'll also hear, building a sense of community. And Brenda went to Tralee for coffee with Bridget Quilligan, Bridget McCarthy and Breda Quilligan.
Bridget, do you want a cup of tea? There's a lovely scone here for you. They're homemade. Hi, my name is Bridget Quilligan.
My name is Bridget McCarthy.
I'm Breda Quilligan.
I feel left out because I'm not called Breed or Bridget.
We won't exclude you. You can be an honorary Bridget for today.
Do you wear that name proudly?
I do now, Brenda. I absolutely love it. But when I was a child growing up, I was called after my grandmother, who I adored. When I grew up, I used to always say, why did she call me Bridget? Why couldn't she call me something fancy like Rachel or Pamela or something nice? Or I'd be watching Dallas and Dynasty and I'd say, why couldn't I be called Crystal? And my mother would say, you're called after a beautiful woman and you're called after the best. So respect your name. And then when I was 13 or 14, I started realising the importance of my name.
I have a granddaughter called Bridget, Bridget May.
She's called after you?
Yes, she is. Both of her grandmothers are Bridget, so they decided to call her Bridget. I didn't like the name Bridget when I was growing up because everywhere you looked, there was a Bridget. Everyone you were talking, there was a Bridget. And it just looked to me at the time as, oh God, they know we're travellers because our name is Bridget. Couldn't hide our identity with the name. Corn, as I got older then, I started to realise, yeah, the name is actually a nice name because they were fading out. There was no travellers then calling their children the Bridgets and the Treases and things like that. But now the names is coming back in. It's actually lovely. And I'll have more grandchildren, please God, the name Bridget.
Whether they like it or not. Yeah.
It's part of the tradition.
Well, I was called after my grandmother. That would have been my father's mother. But all my cousins were called Bridas.
Okay, I'm going to put you on the spot.
Right, okay.
How many Bridgets or Breeds do you think you know?
Oh, I'd say I know a couple of hundred, if not more. But I know a load of girls who is Bridget, but identifies as a different, fancier name.
And you say to them, will you cop on and go back?
Yeah, go back, yeah. Like Bridget said, it's a lovely name. And when you actually go back to who you're called after, kind of gives you a sense of pride. that you're called after a very special person, very special woman in your life, and you have a story, you have a background to it. I mean, you could have a fancy name, but you can't say it's someone from Dallas or Dynasty or, you know. You could actually sit down and say, well, I was called after a very remarkable woman. She achieved this. She was a homemaker. She was a great mother. She was a housekeeper. She was everything that you could... There are the life skills that you actually need today rather than the fancy names.
Bridget Quilligan, you are the project manager. What is it you do?
Essentially, it's a health and community development project, and we have a team of health workers, we have family support workers, men's health workers. As much as all the serious things that's going on here, it's the sense of community that's created. I often was inside my office doing paperwork, and I'd hear roaring laughing inside here, and I'd peep in, and I'd see a large group of women having the best crack and the best fun doing something. And sometimes it's the only opportunity that they get outside of funerals to get together. So it's great to see our women's groups thriving and all the groups meeting and that sense of community, because they're building solidarity and friendship with each other then.
How did it start for you?
Yeah, there was a moment in my life when I said I'd have to do something better for myself. At home every day with the kids, I decided I need to do something for myself. And that's where it began then for me. I did my leaving.
And how old were you when you did your leaving?
I was up about my 30s when I did my leaving.
I think that's very brave to go back. Would you agree and sit that and manage kids and everything at the same time? I think you're kind of super Bridget.
Well, it was challenging now, but I'm glad I did it, as I've achieved so much since I did it. I like making a difference in people's lives.
I grew up in Killarney, and I grew up surrounded by love, I suppose, Brenda, surrounded by a large traveller family, but also my settled neighbours. And I will say that I had an ideal childhood in that I never knew really what much hardship was. And I realised, I suppose, when I was about 16, how badly discriminated against travellers were. When I was in school, I went the normal route, I suppose. I went the average route. I went to secondary school. And when I went out with my friends, I was stopped in a disco. I was the only one there out of a whole group who were stopped. So I kind of realised that no matter what you do or how many boxes you tick, if you are a member of the Charlotte community, you were still going to experience discrimination. So I joined a few different initiatives, and it kind of started my love for advocacy and standing up for people.
I first started off 13 years ago as a health worker. I love being able to help people and supporting them and empowering women to look after themselves. I think you get a sense of pride that you actually made a difference in somebody's life. It's just a great sense of achievement with your job, I think.
I just want to go back to something one of the lads said a while ago. They were talking about naming. There is a tradition in our community that the firstborn sometimes can be called after your husband's family. So you could have many like children in the one family called after the grandmother or the grandfather or whatever. So I'm Bridget Mary, after my two grandmothers. My sister is Mary Margaret, so on and so forth. So each child will take a grandmother's name or an aunt's name in some form or some way, so that everybody in the family is honoured. So no matter where you are, no matter how old you are, your aunt might say, she's called after me. And they'll always get you something extra special,
yeah,
as well, if they think you're called after them.
Of course they would. There are so many Bridgets in your lives. Mm. Pick me the strongest Bridget. How would you compare their life with yours
well,
now?
I never met my grandmother, Bridget. But I had two aunts, and they were larger-than-life characters. Mm. And I always remember as a child, if anything happened or if there was a funeral, these two Bridgets were they would keep everybody's morale up, and even though they were going through such a hard time themselves, but they were just such characters.
Is your life, do you think, better or worse than theirs?
A little bit better, because I think I'm a little bit more independent. But I think we've more support now in the lines of health services and stuff like that, you know.
Bridget McCarthy, what are the values you think those Bridgets gave you that you carry on today?
The values them Bridgets gave us years ago, if we were idle or anything, they'd tell us, get up and do something for yourself. Don't be laying around. Move on. Come on, get up there and clean up or whatever. Wouldn't you do better now if you were doing that for your mother or whatever? She'd always make sure we weren't idled.
Yeah.
Or she'd tell us, go up home for yourself now, you're messing down around there and things. We'd never back answer them or anything like that. We were always taught respect our elders. And I think that's one of my values I bring forward today, that we have more respect for our elders than the crowd coming up today.
my beautiful grandmother, Bridget, my nanny, who I'm called after, all the values that I hold true to me, particularly around family, she instilled in me. My love for cooking came from her. And also, she taught me that I could be anything I wanted in life. She was a very advanced woman for her time. And she'd always warned me and told me, even though my grandfather was very good to her, she said, a woman should always have her own few pound and never let no one know what you have in your bank account, and always have your own little credit union account or bank account with your own few pound in it. And also my faith, which I come back to, and saying the rosary every evening at 6 o'clock. That's something I got from my grandmother.
And the day itself?
For me, it's a very special day because my little boy always, I've only one child, and he always gets me something small. And I get a Bridget cross from my mother and some of my cousins. And my partner is Romanian Gypsy, so he has a tradition where they celebrate their Saints' Day. So I get flowers from him as well for my Saints' Day.
I think now that we discussed a lot about our aunts and our grandparents, I think we've been doing a lot of reflecting on the day as well. And I suppose going back to our childhood and what it was to be growing up with these strong women in our lives. And although we never appreciated it at the time, we thought it was going to live to be 100 or more. But I think there'll be a sense of sadness as well, that we should appreciate them more, but at least we'll have an opportunity to celebrate them along with celebrate St. Bridget's Day as well.
Yeah. Nice bit of a treat.
Have a nice cup of coffee and...
I'm the better for having heard that now. Bridget Quilligan, Bridget McCarthy and Breda Quilligan. And Brenda Donoghue is having Super Bridget t-shirts made up as we speak. Before I go, I want to say goodbye to another remarkable woman this morning. We lost an extraordinary colleague yesterday. Claire Pryor was a name that you'll have heard at the end of many, many programmes on this station. You'll even have heard her on air, though not remotely enough. Sharp wit, sharp elbows, brightest point of view, best arguments, best fun, the best of us, and easily the bravest person I've ever met. One of those people who make this place one of the best to work in. We really could only hope that her like will be seen again. So from all of us here, we're sharing thoughts and love with David and Evan this morning. That's all that we have for you this week. Thanks for listening. Have a good weekend.
Countrywide on RTE Radio 1. Listen back on the RTE Radio Player.